I'm Lindy Paxton from IndyCar on Versus, and you need more front wing.
Position. There's no question for that. Those two had been running close to side by side at the exit of turn number two.
For the PPG Cup. Look, oh, look, 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 here he comes, here he comes, and he gets him! Can he get him back? Can he hang on?
Hello and welcome to the More Front Wing podcast. Gosh, that sounds good to say, doesn't it, Paul?
Absolutely. Finally.
After working so long at it, yeah. So, hi, I'm Steph, here with Paul, and the same team as always was at Planet IRL, but now we come to you from More Front Wing with the same type of podcast content that we've had all along and looking forward to bringing it to you under our new banner. So we've got a few topics to cover with you this week. We're going to start going over just the last couple of oval races and previewing the rest of the season on the oval tracks that remain as well. We're also going to talk a little bit about the situation with Dan Weldon and Panther Racing. We're going to talk about the schedule prior to the announcement that is coming out this Friday. And we have an interview for you with the venerable Eddie Gossage from Texas Motor Speedway as well a little later on. But first things first, we are in the final stint of the season with the ovals, and Paul and I both were fortunate enough to be in attendance at Chicago, which was a great race. It's too bad nobody actually showed up to watch it, but it was certainly a great on-track product. And I think the primary feeling that Paul and I both came away from that event with was that it is quite evident the reasoning behind why we're not expecting to see any ISC tracks on the schedule next year.
Yeah, you know, it was just obvious all weekend, from literally from the time I showed up on Thursday to pick up credentials until the time I left on Saturday night, that there was just no passion for the Izod IndyCar Series at the track. I showed up Thursday at the main tunnel that all the teams use. They are greeted by a large Sprint Cup banner billboard there saying "Welcome Sprint Cup." There was literally no IndyCar paraphernalia anywhere adorning the track, while there was plenty of NASCAR stuff here, there, and everywhere. The track president, Craig Rust, who was supposed to have been a quote-unquote friend to the IndyCar series, I never saw him a single time all weekend, never heard from him. Typically, the track owners and promoters will come to the media center and try to put their best spin on things about what they're doing with their track. Usually give us some lame excuse about, you know, why attendance is a little down, or try to tell us that it's actually good. Craig Rust never showed up. I never saw him a single time. And I spent a lot of time in the media center. It was just obvious. The whole weekend there was, and it goes beyond the weekend. I mean, this started weeks and months ago. There was never any promotion from the track, period, for the IndyCar race. Right up until...
No, I mean, right, even that weekend, we were talking that weekend about the fact that I didn't arrive till Saturday morning, so I was at home on Friday night checking things online, and the Chicagoland Speedway Twitter account didn't even have any IndyCar content. I think they had 3 or 4 tweets related to IndyCar on Friday. They didn't talk about the qualifying at all. They didn't announce who the pole sitter was for the race the next day, and yet there was a solid, what was it, about 4 hours of tweeting content for the truck race that night. And a few of us called the track out on Twitter and said, this is ridiculous. It wasn't even ignorance. It was omission. And
they didn't take kindly to being called out about it either.
No, they did do some more tweeting about it the next day after being called out about it. But if nobody had said anything, I can't help but speculate about how thin the content would have been.
And even the day of the race, if you went to the Chicagoland Speedway site, before you got there, there was a large pop-up that you had to go through, and it boldly proclaimed, "We're in the chase." That's good news. I'm glad to get my IndyCar information that way. You know, it was obvious that they didn't care.
And it's the same at every ISC track.
Absolutely.
It's been the same all year long, so it's disappointing. I mean, everybody loves Chicago. It produces great racing. It should be so much bigger an event than it is, but you can't force a promoter to care. And when there are promoters on staff, there's no reason for the IndyCar series to need to take that cost on their own. So it just doesn't make any sense.
Which is why, as much as we want, a race at Phoenix is never going to be successful again, simply by forcing the IndyCar series upon the track, whether it's as a bargaining chip to get the IndyCar series to go back to Fontana, or some other track that ISC wants to play games with. If ISC wants IndyCar, again, let's say at California Fontana, and they say, okay, well, you guys can go to Phoenix in exchange for that, the guy at Phoenix that's the president there now is the same one that's been there since, I think, 2001 or 2002. He didn't care then, he didn't promote then, and he's not going to care or promote now. We would end up in the same situation. Somebody said they had 10,000 people at the last IndyCar race at Phoenix. Well, Steph, you and I were standing there after the race talking with the team owner at Chicago, and you know, he has pretty good knowledge of the track and said that he thought maybe about 8,000 people for the IndyCar race there. And that's,
you mean at Chicago, right?
Yes, at Chicago.
Yeah.
And that's not going to cut it. I don't care who's forced upon it or who's paying the sanctioning fee. I don't care if you're at Kokomo Speedway trying to get an IndyCar race there. You can't support a top-level open-wheel series with 8,000 fans there. I don't care if you don't put a dime into your marketing. You still can't support that. And that's why we're not going to see any ISC tracks on the IndyCar schedule next year. So as your second time back at the track, what were your opinions this time back? Were they different than what you saw last year, or pretty much in line with what you saw?
I felt everything was near identical to what I saw last year, actually. Last year, there was no promotion. Last year, the crowd size was about the same. I didn't see anything special about any of the concessions or the souvenir offerings or anything. It could have been the same weekend for all it felt to me. The only thing that was missing, truthfully, was the gigantic Vision Racing tweet up. Because I met so many people at that event last year, and this year we did have a tweet up, but it was organized pretty last minute and it didn't have quite the massive pull that we were hoping for. And it was great to see all those people again, don't get me wrong, but it definitely is something that will be missed. The fantastic Pat Caporale, unfortunately, has moved on from Vision Racing through some events beyond her control, and it's an amicable parting of ways, but it is most disappointing because Pat was extremely talented at her work, and there doesn't seem to be anybody stepping up to fill the void at the moment, which is a real shame because the social media community of IndyCar was blossoming so well toward the end of last year, and now it feels a little bit like we've taken a step backward. But I do hope that someone steps up and tries to get that going again for next season, because it's an immeasurably valuable asset to the IndyCar community if it's done properly.
Yeah, and you and I have had the opportunity to get to know Pat pretty well over the last year or so, and you've probably known her a little longer than I have. But I don't think there's anyone that can really argue that the growth and the explosion of social media over the last 18 months has been almost solely the work of Pat Caporale. When she was working with Vision Racing, she blew the lid off of this thing. There was nobody from a team, from a league, really even from a driver's standpoint, who did as much to promote the league and the series, not just Vision Racing, but to promote the IndyCar series as a whole, as what Pat did. And like you said, she's sorely going to be missed in the paddock, and we hope that she finds her way back to the series very, very soon.
Absolutely. Continuing on the theme of looking backward, there have been a couple of teams that have been quite consistent in the two ovals so far, and it would be interesting to see that carry on through the rest of the year. One that we're watching with great interest is Conquest Racing and Bertrand Baguette, who we weren't as surprised to see do well on the road courses, although anytime that somebody puts a Conquest car in the top 10, it's pretty surprising. But to see him up in the toward the front in, I mean, he was up to third, I think, at one point, wasn't he?
He was, yeah, at the very beginning of the race, yeah.
Yeah, and in Conquest equipment, that is no small feat. So he's actually proving himself to possibly be an excellent choice for American Open Wheel, and in that he seems to have the diverse skill that's required to pull this off. And seeing that in a rookie to come over from Europe and pulling that off in his first year is absolutely impressive.
You know, I can remember you and I walking the paddock in Toronto. We were walking the paddock there together. And I said at the time, I said, you know, somebody really needs to start taking a look at Conquest Racing and give them some attention, some love for what they've done this year, because they probably have the smallest budget of anyone in the league. They've just gone about their business. They haven't been flashy. They haven't been showy. They haven't even been particularly good. I mean, they're not running up at the front of the field, but they're doing their business right. They're showing up week in, week out. You can tell they're working hard. They're making steady advancements. that we've seen here in the last couple of weeks, especially this weekend at Kentucky. They don't tear up their equipment between Mario Romancini and Bertrand Baguette, and then they've had Thomas Schechter in the last couple of weeks. They just seem like they do things right, and they don't make a big show of what they do, but they're making steady progress. And I think there's a lot of teams that can learn from what Conquest is doing. I think they're a team, like you said, that really deserves some credit and some attention and some kudos for the way they've conducted themselves, how they've presented themselves, how they've raced this year. Because I think they really have been a team that has exceeded their means.
Another team that has been performing more strongly on the ovals, and it's less of a surprise, although there's still some items to be discussed, is Andretti Autosport. There was a bit of controversy in the paddock this weekend surrounding what may or may not have been a technical issue with the Andretti cars after the Chicagoland race. The details are sort of spotty at this point, but we are led to understand from a couple of whispers in the paddock that those four cars may not have passed the technical inspection after Chicago. They all finished, as you'll recall, extremely well in that race. Seems there may have been something not quite right with the under tray that may have been confiscated, which could have contributed to their difficulties early in the weekend in Kentucky, although it seems that they got themselves sorted out as they all finished not as strongly as they did in Chicago, but fairly well in the end. So, as I said, details are spotty. We don't know a lot about it. The league doesn't really discuss these sorts of things, and that's a shame. Yet another one of these things that is apparently none of our business. And it's really too bad that there's not greater communication about these sorts of issues, as I know that it's something that all of the fans, an aspect of the sport that people are inclined to take interest in. But nonetheless, it is what it is, and we move on, I suppose.
You know, I'm a little bit surprised that we aren't hearing anything more about this, because Randy Bernard has really done a good job of adding some transparency to the league.
He has, but I don't know that Randy Bernard would see this as something being under his area to blow the lid off of. I think he very much sees this as being Brian Barnhart's territory, and there have been a couple of conversations that we've had with him where he'll talk very openly about things that he's got his fingers into, but when it's something that he's trusted to Brian Barnhart, he'll say, no, that's Brian's gig, and I'm not going to talk about that, leave that to him.
True, but in an overall sense, we have seen more transparency this year. Look at the Elio Castroneves issue at Edmonton. We never heard previously about fines for drivers. We heard that they were fined, but there was always fined an undisclosed amount. This year we heard for the first time, really, that Elio was fined $60,000 for his actions off the track. That's
well, it
not
could
something
be that
we've heard before.
So it could be that it's a work in progress.
It could be. Yeah, certainly. But with Randy understands that those are issues that lead not only transparency things that the fans want, but also leads to credibility, to let the fans know that the league isn't looking more favorably upon one team than they are another. You know, if this was Dale Coyne Racing, would they have been slapped with a fine or penalty? Would they have been on probation the next week? Would there have been some sort of penalty there? You know, we don't know. We don't know what happened behind the scenes with Andretti. So those are the types of things. I think Randy sees that credibility, and the credibility of the series is very important to Randy. We heard that when he talked about Milka Duno being on probation, saying that the credibility of the series was in jeopardy when we don't take action against the drivers that don't meet the standard of the league. So those types of things are very important to him. He realizes that they're important to the fan base as well. So from that standpoint, I'm a little bit surprised that he hasn't opened the book a little bit more towards some of these penalties, towards these infractions that are going on. Not that we've heard a whole lot of infractions, but certainly in this case, I was a little bit surprised that this was kept quite as hush-hush as it was. The buzz that I had heard about was that the tunnels had been narrowed, or they were narrower than what the spec was. So now whether that's true or not, I don't know. To me, it would seem like a narrower tunnel would actually hurt the Andretti cars more than it would help, reducing mechanical grip and making you rely more upon aero grip. So that made, you know, like I said, that was kind of secondhand, kind of the buzz I had heard going around. But from an engineering standpoint, I don't have the background, and it'd be interesting to speak with somebody who does to see if that would actually help or hurt, because in my knowledge of physics, which is enough to get me dangerous in the conversation, it would seem that would be a hindrance instead of a helpful aspect. But that would certainly be an under tray issue, that there aren't too many issues of the under tray that you could think of that would be that you could really adjust legally or illegally, other than the tunnels, whether the tunnel narrower or deeper is really about the only way you can go with those.
Well, and that whole discussion gets into how tightly closed should the rule book be, and that's a discussion that could probably go on for hours, so I don't think we want to go down that road in the scope of one podcast, but it is something that's certainly interesting to consider from a number of angles.
Well, I think we both agree that we would like to see these penalties publicized, or at least absolutely, the infractions publicized.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Openness is good.
Yes.
Gives us media and blogger types more to talk about.
There you go.
Anyway, back to the teams that we want to give a nod to. Absolutely a fan favorite, the last team that we wanted to discuss, which is the partnership between Panther Racing and Vision Racing, which has, I don't think there's anybody who hasn't been surprised at how well they've gone for the last couple of races, and that pairing of Ed Carpenter and Dan Weldon seems to be going extremely well.
I am surprised that there are as many people surprised at Ed Carpenter's performance as there are. Ed has been a very solid performer on the ovals the last several years, whether you look at Indianapolis, you look at the D-shaped mile-and-a-half ovals, or you look at something a little bit different like a Homestead, for example. I think last year he started third or fourth and ran very well early on in that race as well.
The difference being, this year, we haven't seen him since Indy.
Right.
And he's been consistently strong when we have seen him, as infrequent as it has been.
And I'm sure that the detractors will look at that another way and say, oh, look, this guy can just jump in a car and now all of a sudden he's running right up front. Let's not take anything away from Ed. That guy can drive on an oval. I think he'll admit he doesn't have the skill set, or at least the experience, to run probably as competitively on the road course. But this is a guy that can wheel a car on an oval. And I think I think Dan Weldon would admit that he has made that team better the last 2 weeks on the ovals. Because Panther didn't look particularly well earlier in the year on the first stretch of ovals. They had the runner-up at Indianapolis, but I don't recall them running particularly well at Kansas, Iowa. I don't recall them running really strongly or necessarily at Texas either. I think Ed has brought a lot to that team. I think it helps having a teammate for Weldon. He performed obviously very well at Andretti when he had teammates. He performed well at Ganassi when he was teamed with Scott Dixon. So I think he likes having a teammate. I think Ed is a very good teammate on the ovals, very technically minded. Has a good engineering sense of the car and can provide that good feedback that they're looking for.
Now, wouldn't it be interesting, because Marshall Pruitt released an article yesterday talking about Panther, and he had a discussion with John Barnes about what their plans are for next year, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. But wouldn't it be interesting to see, because Panther is discussing whether they're going to have one or two cars, wouldn't it be cool to have Ed do part-time on the ovals, gunning for the Oval Championship, and a road course specialist, I'm thinking maybe J.K. Vernay, sitting in it for the road courses, going after the road course championship, and you've got one entry that's in every race getting the team money, and everybody's happy.
Yeah, that is certainly a possibility. I can think of another initialed name, Jay, that would also be a nice fit into a National Guard Panther car.
Oh, you mean Captain America?
That would be a great, I think that would be a great way to go about it. A good way to get JR some exposure into the series if he doesn't possibly have enough funding to get a full season ride. I think that would be a very interesting scenario that would be beneficial to him and the team.
And we may see a couple more partnerships like that next year, given that there's actually a little bit more motivation to make such arrangements, what with the separate championships to go for.
Well, not only that, I think people are saying that next year is going to be a bit of a throwaway year. It's kind of a lame duck season for these cars. Nobody's going to want to make the investment to get in next year while, you know, the cars become obsolete.
On the other hand, if there are people that have extra equipment sitting around that are willing to sell it and gamble on not needing it next year, there could be some people.
Exactly.
Who
I think
could, you know, buy it up at bargain basement prices. And,
exactly. The cost to get in on the game is going to be significantly lower, I think, next year, because the guys, you know, Penske or Andretti or, you know, all these teams that have these extra tubs laying around, you know, you don't need 8 tubs for 3 guys. You don't need 6 tubs for 2 guys necessarily.
If of course, you can, we're assuming that KV will actually let anybody in the series have any left at the end of this year.
That's true. They may use them to that.
That joke just never gets old.
It doesn't. Which, by the way, I did a very good job of keeping track of what they've spent this year.
I've lost track, haven't you?
I lost track after Toronto. They were, I think they were at 20 or 21 after Toronto. Latest number I heard was 32, 30.
I heard, yeah, low 30s.
Ugh.
It's just ridiculous.
Sato didn't even get through the first lap.
And we're not talking little scratches here.
No, that was...
We're talking seriously torn up equipment. It's, yeah.
Now, Chicago, luckily for them, I think that was probably a pretty cheap weekend. They had the pit road incident where they took each other out. Luckily, I think their damage was pretty cosmetic there. A broken wing mount on the Sato car, maybe a broken suspension on the Viso car. Things that would normally be able to be fixed. I got the impression from them at Chicago that they thought, let's quit while we're ahead. We're only about $20,000 in the hole right now.
Well, weren't we walking through the paddock in Chicago and the KV hauler was pulling out and everybody said, stand back, might hit somebody.
It took the poor KV driver about 5 attempts to get out of the garage area. We thought for sure he wasn't going to hit anything.
No, it's just running jokes are just great.
Right, right. But anyway, getting back to where we started this conversation, my understanding is that Target Ganassi has 6 tubs in their arsenal. They have 3 for each of the drivers. If Chip Ganassi decides, you know, all of these are going to be worth nothing at the end of the year, let's unload 2 of these, and each driver can have 2. I'm going to put my 2 extra tubs up for sale for $200,000 each. Well, now all of a sudden, that's a significant decrease on the initial investment required to get into the series for a young team. Whether DeFerrin Dragon has been rumored to be adding a second car. Now, that's one place I've heard rumors lately that if Penske does reduce to a 2-car team, that one of those cars, which you would have to assume would be Briscoe, could move back to the DeFerrin Dragon, make that a 2-car team, and hopefully get Rafa Matos some much-needed support on that team. Anywhere around those young teams that are being rumored to expand, to be starting for next year, you know, get into the league before the switchover in 2012, those chassis in this offseason are going to be as cheap as they're ever going to be.
Yeah, another team we're hearing might be coming out of the woodwork for next year is Rahal Letterman. The rumors on that one have been quite strong.
Which will be really interesting because the rumor is that Graham Rahal, the Quick Trim sponsorship that Graham is running now at Newman Haas is actually a Rahal Letterman sponsorship that they've farmed over to Newman Haas. Well, if that's Graham Rahal sponsorship that they want to run at Newman at Rahal Letterman next year, well, Marshall Pruitt is saying that Graham Rahal is first in line at the Panther spot to take over Dan Weldon's seat, which we'll probably get into a little bit later. So now it's a question, where does Graham actually fit into all of this? But you can see the silly season starting to unravel a little bit. I don't think a 27, 28, 29 car fields are going to necessarily be the exception next year. I think those are going to be the norms. I think we're going to see teams expanding next year. I think we're going to see a couple new teams come on board. And I don't think we're going to have much in the way of contraction of any of the teams, with a few maybe rare exceptions here and there. I think we're going to see a very healthy field next year, and I think it's because of this reduced cost to enter next year.
We've sort of run the gamut on topics here. The one thing that we did want to come back around to is talking about the seat that's currently occupied by Dan Weldon, though, because after the Kentucky race, he blatantly said in his post-race interview that he's looking for a job next year, which Panther has turned around and said is not necessarily true. There was a tweet from their account today saying that they simply have not decided and that they may very well bring Dan back. But the discussion has been very strong for the last couple of years now that the relationship between the team and Dan has not always been perfectly amicable. So I don't think it would surprise anyone now that he's at the end of his contract to see one or the other party decide that it's time for Dan to move on. We've talked about the Panther side of things, the fact that Graham is reportedly very high on their list. We're hearing things like J.R. Hildebrand being considered for that one as well, due, of course, to the fact that there's the National Guard sponsorship on the number 4 car, and there's an overwhelmingly strong sentiment that there should be an American representing that organization in that car. So I'm
not sure.
I've even
heard the rumor that Paul Tracy may be in line for that car.
Yeah, I don't know how many people think of Paul as not being American, other than Canadians.
It goes back to my whole argument that the American public isn't necessarily clear-cut on having an American, so long as it's American-sounding, been my opinion all along. Yes. Paul Tracy sounds American.
You always like to mention how if you put Roger Yaskawa in that car, people would be up in arms.
Absolutely.
Yes. Anyhow, I think that the team side of things we've covered pretty thoroughly, but that leaves us with the question of where does Dan end up? Because Dan likes to get paid.
Dan is getting paid. Yeah, Dan is getting paid well. Somewhere in the $2.5 to $3 million range.
There are not very many seats left around where you get paid. Not especially not that kind of money.
Ooh.
And he's been through Andretti, he's been through Ganassi. There aren't any seats at Penske. If anything, they might go down a car, if that, and that would surprise me.
I would say of those three, I would see the Andretti as the most likely. I think that bridge is still pretty tender at Ganassi, the way he left there amidst the Tony Kanaan rumors a couple of years ago.
But Andretti's already to a point wrestling with keeping Ryan Hunter Ray in his seat. I don't see them finding a way. And the other three drivers are pretty secure for next year, I would think. So, I mean, if we were looking at 2012 and whether TK takes the option on his contract, we'd be talking about a different matter. But for next year, I think that roster is pretty much set.
I would agree.
And I don't see them running more than four cars on a regular basis.
Oh, I agree. Which means it kind of gets me back to what are the good seats that are left? We don't see Newman Haas, unfortunately, right now in a position to pay healthy sums. I mean, they've got the money from Hideki Muto right now paying his, and they've kind of pilfered off the Ray Hall Letterman sponsorship for the second.
KB is not paying drivers. We know that for a fact.
KB's not paying drivers. If KV is going to continue to forge ahead with this alliance they have with Lotus through their Cosworth, obviously Kevin Kalkoven owns Cosworth, and Cosworth is an alliance with Lotus. It's very difficult to see Dan Weldon going to that team, given his very strong ties to Honda that he's had really since he came to the IndyCar Series in 2003. So I don't see him going to KV.
I think the greater reason why he's not going to go to KB is because he doesn't have a sponsor to bring with him, and he likes to get paid.
Well, that too. Kevin Kalkoven has money, though. He could pay a driver if he...
Yeah, but he doesn't want to spend it.
He doesn't want to spend his money, but he also doesn't want to repair 31 race cars next year through 15 events.
No, but if they cut Sato and keep the other two, I think they might be happy. Not that the other
Sato's
two are any
had
better,
DNS
but Sato's
cheaper.
Just cutting Sato from their lineup will save them so much money.
I don't know. I mean, Sato's had 9 DNFs this year. He had at least one other accident at Indianapolis, so that's only, you're talking 10 or 11. Viso and Marias have definitely wadded up their fair share of equipment this year as well. So we can't point the finger there solely at Sato. There's blame to go around there. And I think Kalkoven has easily spent $2 million this year repairing the cars that those three have crashed.
But it hasn't been his own money.
It hasn't been his own money, you're right. But somewhere along the line, I don't think he's going to go there, but I think that if he wanted Dan, he could get that money to appear for Dan. He's a businessman, he's got interest. I think he can make that happen.
Well, it would be interesting to see a stable driver in one of those seats for a change. The other speculation that I've heard whispers of is that maybe the second car discussion for DeFerrin Dragon might have something to do with Dan. Whether that's true, I don't know.
I think my guess would be him going to Ray Hall if that does actually come to fruition. And
again, with what money? He has no sponsor to bring with him. And Ray Hall Letterman, if they had a sponsor they apparently have Quick Trim, but if they had somebody with significant money, it would be going to Graham, not to Dan.
Well, not if Graham is going to Panther to run it under the National Guard colors.
Hmm.
If the Quick Trim sponsorship is Ray Hall Letterman's, then that sponsorship should stay there and not follow.
Don't see the Quick Trim having enough money to pay Dan Weldon.
Well, he may not get the $2 million he's looking for.
And not being in equipment that's necessarily up to the standard that he's used to, I can't imagine he'd stay happy for very long.
He may not have many options in the way of other options, though, either.
No, it's an interesting situation. But I recall having all of the same discussion at the end of last year, and it ended up being all for naught. So we'll see what happens. Silly season is what it is.
Right.
So moving on, let's talk about a slightly different topic. Let's talk about the schedule announcement that's coming out this Friday. we know that the announcement is taking place at the Milwaukee Mile. It would be rather goofy for it to be happening there and not have the Milwaukee Mile be a part of the schedule. So that is one thing that IndyCar fans have been clamoring for since we found out about this time last year that Milwaukee was not going to be on the 09 schedule, that it appears to be coming to fruition. And that is something that Randy Bernard has said several times that he was very much gunning for. So good to see that come to fruition. But we still do have some other points that may or may not be surprises. Through the couple of articles that I've written for the site, I had been developing a schedule in progress. We know a little bit more than we did even though the last time I wrote one. So Paul and I sat down tonight and came up with what we think was going to be the 2011 IndyCar schedule. So I'll just talk you through it really quickly. I don't think there'll be very many surprises here. The first six, seven races we're pretty sure on. We're looking at St. Pete as the season opener on March 27th because we are under the impression that Brazil is moving further into the season. So we're speculating that that would be the last weekend of March to match up with this year. And then filtering down from there, we will have Barber, Long Beach in their same relative positions as they were this year. Long Beach is already advertising April 17th as their date, so should be pretty much set in stone. People are taking this Brazil moving to May 1st as being gospel at this stage, so I think we can count on that. And that is kind of a good time for it because it gives a week after Long Beach and a week before things get started at Indianapolis for them to get down there and back. So it's fairly safe bet. Indy, of course, is May 29th. We know that Texas is June 11th. We're not guessing that Milwaukee is going to end up being the weekend after Indy, simply because when the Texas Twin races were announced, Randy Bernard said at that time that he wanted to have an off weekend after Indy to promote the heck out of the Indy 500 winner and do some promotion leading into the Texas race. So that would be a big surprise if it did end up getting its traditional date back. Besides the fact that I think that Randy wants to give a nod to Eddie Gossage and giving him the date that comes right after Indy, even if it's not the weekend after. So moving on from there, we know that Iowa is June 25th because that's been announced. The weekend after that is the July 4th weekend, which Randy Bernard has said he wants to leave open, so we're assuming that he's going to do so. After that is the traditional, what's again becoming the traditional date for Toronto. That would put it on July 10th. We're assuming that Edmonton will follow a week later yet again, putting it on July 17th, because there are a lot of reasons to keep the two Canadian dates together from an administrative standpoint. Which brings us into the stretch between that and early August, which is where we believe Milwaukee will slot in. The Brickyard 400 is on July 31st next year, which leads us to think that Milwaukee may land on July 24th. Because it's not a terrible trek to get from Edmonton back down to Milwaukee for that event. And that lets the IMS folks have the Brickyard 400 weekend focus on that and take us into Mid-Ohio, which has not itself been announced, but the ALMS schedule, when it was released, showed the ALMS expecting to run at Mid-Ohio on August 6th. So there's every reason to think that that will continue to be a doubleheader weekend and that IndyCars will be on the 7th. From there, we know that New Hampshire's on August 14th, and Sonoma could end up being on either August 21st or August 28th and not really surprise anyone. And either way, it's going to be bumping up against a race weekend that's way on the other end of the country. So it, administratively, unless there's some event or another that would affect it, it's really hard to say one way or the other. We kind of think maybe August 28th, just to put the off weekend before instead of after, don't know. Could end up going the other way, wouldn't make a difference. We know that Baltimore is on September 4th, the Labor Day weekend next year. And if we go 2 weeks after that, then we've got Motegi on September 18th. And we know that Kentucky is on October 2nd. So other than slotting Milwaukee in where we have, the only real question mark we have left is where is the finale going to be? We have two strong rumored possibilities. The favor seems to be leaning toward Las Vegas at this point, that Randy Bernard has actually made the arrangements. Britton Smith appeared in the media center over the Kentucky weekend and said that he was very much hoping that IndyCar would run their finale at Vegas next year. If SMI is on board and Randy Bernard is on board and they've managed to get it done, then we could very well see that happening. Now, we're hearing that there's 16 races confirmed and a 17th that may be left to be confirmed after the announcement this week, and that would explain a lot of why that might be the case for that one. The other bit of speculation about the finale is that if for some reason Las Vegas falls through, we may see it end up at Fontana, which would make Fontana the only ISC track that would be on the schedule next year. Either way, we think the date of it is going to be October 16th because we think that the series is going to want a weekend in between to do some promotion leading up to the series finale.
The only other opinion I would offer is that you could conceivably get Milwaukee in the week between Loudon and Infineon, slotted in there August 21st. The reason I hesitate to put it in July 21st is that is a really, really long trek back from Edmonton. Probably not significantly different than what the teams did this year when they went from Infineon to Chicago.
I don't know about that. It's not as bad as it looks. And I mean, they're going from Toronto to Edmonton in a week before that, and they don't have to, I don't think they have to change very much of the setup to go from Edmonton to Milwaukee's short oval.
But they also wouldn't need to change much. If they go from Loudon, basically stop
at Milwaukee.
I don't see,
no, because if you're making them go to Milwaukee after Loudon, you're not giving them a single off weekend in August.
That's the only one is, yeah, you got 5 weeks race weekends in a row.
There's no way. They can't do that.
So Edmonton, yeah, that weekend after Edmonton would just about be the only time.
Mm-hmm. So I think we've pretty much got it nailed down here, but Friday will come around and we'll see if we're right or we're wrong. And until then, it's all speculation, isn't it? So
it is, but I think we agree with some of our friends at some other racing sites as well. So we're, in fact, that list that we just went through there lines up almost exactly the same as there. So I think the truth is probably pretty close to that. I think we're finally in a place where we know what events are going to be there, sans the finale at either Las Vegas or Fontana. But now it's just a matter of where we fit in that last piece of the puzzle. I don't think you can't run it after Baltimore, I don't think, and push Motegi back. So I agree. You have to put it in the middle of the summer. Conceivably, you could run it July 4th weekend.
Randy Bernard has already said, and he said it over and over and over during the Watkins Glen weekend, that he didn't want to run on July 4th weekend because they don't get corporate support.
What I took from that, and again, I wasn't there listening to it specifically, but what I had took from reading other reports was he didn't want to be in Watkins Glen over the 4th of July weekend, where he's way far away.
No, I was there, and he was being pretty clear that he felt that that was a poor weekend in general to run because corporate does not want to be attending race weekends. They want to be hanging out with their families.
But they are running the three-day weekend over Labor Day weekend.
Which surprised me, but I guess he doesn't see Labor Day weekend as being the same, or somebody convinced him that it was worth a shot. But he was very clear at Watkins Glen that weekend he considered off-limits, and I would be very surprised if he went against that.
Well, there you go. July 24th. We're calling it there. Kentucky will be a Sunday afternoon race. It is moving back to the afternoon.
I have to confess, I didn't look at the date that closely. They're running on a Sunday afternoon?
It'll be a Sunday afternoon. Are you serious?
That is stupid.
I'm sure October 2nd was a date. They're not going to run it on a Sunday night.
I'm sure it was, too. They can't have seriously be doing that on a Sunday afternoon in football season, can they?
Running up against the Bengals? Better hope the Bengals are out of town.
Never mind that. The TV audience will be brutal.
Kevin says this morning they haven't announced a specific time for the race, but it figures to be daytime because it will be October 2nd in the Midwest. Probably will be chilly by evening.
Wow. That's going to hurt attendance and TV viewership at that event quite a bit. I'm not sure that's the most wise decision. I guess we'll see how it plays out. Well, it'll be an interesting experiment anyway. It could very well be that all of our concerns of the NFL being too big of a pull are unfounded. Or maybe they are completely well-founded and nobody will show up and this will be re-examined for next year. We'll see what happens.
One of the things we do know about this schedule next year, though, is that the race after the 500 will be the dual sprints at Texas. We had a chance to speak with Eddie Gossage a couple weeks ago. I guess it's been about 10 days ago now we spoke with him. We discussed a number of issues with Eddie. We discussed how the idea of the dual races came about. We also had a chance to discuss the relationship that seems to be budding and solidifying between the Izod IndyCar Series and Speedway Motorsports Incorporated. So with that, let's take a listen then to the interview that I did with Eddie Gossage, president of Texas Motor Speedway, about 10 days ago, reflecting some of these topics. All right, we're pleased to be joined now by the president of the Texas Motor Speedway, Mr. Eddie Gossage. Eddie, first of all, thanks so much again for joining us this evening.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. Let me start first with talking about the news that you guys recently announced at Texas concerning the IndyCar, the Firestone 275 duels down there. How did this whole idea come about and get started with Randy and the whole discussion of the duels there?
Well, Randy Bernard, the new chairman of the Indy Racing League, he and I had dinner back in January when he was in Texas. Actually, it was the final event during his tenure with the Professional Bull Riders Tour. He was here for that event, and we had dinner during the week prior to that. And we'd met a couple times before, but it was a chance for us to visit one-on-one for a while, and we talked about a variety of things. And one of the questions he asked me is, you know, what's something you've always wanted to do with the Indy Racing League, but you've never, you know, been successful pulling off? And we talked about a variety of things. One of them was the idea of twin races, and it stuck with him. He liked it, and so we continued to talk about it since that night. And you know, one of those things that just changes up the evening. You know, it has history, which to me is very important. To a lot of people, you know, my history in IndyCar racing goes back 30 years. I love the sport and been attending IndyCar races, been involved in the sport for 30 years now, and it's important to me, the heritage of the sport, and there have been 17, 18, 19, something like that, IndyCar races over the years that have been twin events. Michigan used to have two 250-mile events, twin 250s, things of that nature. Atlanta, I think, was the last track that had twin races. So it's got heritage, and you know, it's kind of hard in our sport, in IndyCar racing, to do something new. You know, if it's got a little history to it, got a little heritage to it, it's a little easier to pull off. And because of that, you know, why not? And if it works and everybody enjoys it, great. And if it doesn't, we can always go back to the way it used to be. So no harm, no foul. And I think it's going to make for an interesting evening. And after the Indianapolis 500 is over in May of 2011, there's going to be 2 weeks where we're going to talk about the new Indy 500 champ and what fun that was. And man, what's going to happen 2 weeks, Saturday night in Texas, the twin races. What's that going to mean? How's it going to play out? Those are the things you need, the word of mouth, the buzz, to create successful promotion, and I think the twins will do that for us. So an old idea is new again, and that's basically all it amounts to.
Now, one of the criticisms that I've read is that basically what you've done is you've taken one race and split it into two equal halves. Was there any consideration to making the sum of the parts, if you will, making that a longer race, maybe you know, a 400-mile race or, you know, 650, 700K race?
Well, the Indy Racing League has been very resistant to lengthen the race. We went from 500 kilometers to 550 kilometers two or three years ago, and they're reluctant to go past that. I'd like for it to be longer just because I think that the American sporting public is really conditioned for three-hour events. You know, an NFL game, a Major League Baseball game, a college football game, et cetera, are typically three-hour events. But they've been resistant to that because of the, you know, the intensity of this event, the G-forces that you're pulling, the you know, what the body has to endure to run further than 550 kilometers. They just really have avoided wanting to go there. So that's their call. You know, I'm going to continue to push for it to be longer. I'd love to see a 500-mile event personally. I'm a traditionalist in so many ways, and 500-milers are very traditional for our sport. And if they can do it in Indianapolis, I think they could probably do it here too. But I have to defer to our friends in Indianapolis.
Well, from a personal standpoint, I think it would be really neat to go to that 700K where you can market it as, you know, the Firestone 700, which comes out to, you know, 410-15 miles, somewhere in that ballpark. So, you know, they have a history of going that distance.
Yeah, fairly. There's all kinds of ways to look at it, and you know, the bottom line is we're going to continue to try and do the things that intrigue the fans, and we've done that here, but the more we can do in the future with the Indy Racing League's help, the better for everybody.
Now, with regards to the second race and how they qualify or line up for that, is that something you kind of want to keep close to the vest for a while, or do you even really control that, or is that from
I don't have any control over that. That's one of those that's one of those things that has been real interesting to kind of watch. What's Eddie going to do with setting the starting lineup for the second race? Eddie's not going to do anything because the Indy Racing League will determine how qualifying is conducted. And, you know, we've talked about different concepts and the need to perhaps do something other than simply start it straight up based on the finish of the first race. But nothing's been determined. And I don't think there's any rush to make a decision on that. You can do all kinds of things. You know, it's funny. IndyCar racing fans are such a split group. You've got folks that love Saturday night short track racing and believe that's the only way that you should be able to matriculate your way to Indianapolis. And then there are others that believe that, you know, European style road racing, et cetera, that's the only way you should be able to earn your way to Indianapolis. And like I said, that causes for a split. But if you are the old school, you know, American short track kind of guy, then you're used to heat races, or you're used to inverting a certain number of people, or any other form of qualifying for a variety of races. So, it's funny to sometimes you hear the criticism and you kind of go, these same people that say that you should, you know, be coming from the dirt tracks of Kokomo to get to Indianapolis, but they, I don't know. So it's always an interesting to listen to IndyCar fans because they're such a mixed bag, and that diversity is kind of what makes it a little bit of fun, though.
Well, let's talk about IndyCar in general here a little bit more. Obviously, you've probably, well, not probably, outside of Indianapolis, you are, bar none, the most successful promoter of the IndyCar series year in and year out. What are the biggest issues that you face as a promoter in selling the IndyCar brand to the public?
Well, you know, first of all, I think as a promoter, you've got to realize that promotion is a 365-day-a-year thing. It's not something that you do for a couple of weeks, a couple of months leading up to your event. It's something that you have to do all the time. And one of my, the staff right here will tell you, I say it repeatedly, day in and day out, if we don't make a big deal out of it, nobody else will. And so we make a big deal out of IndyCar racing, and we treat it every bit the equal to our NASCAR races, which for some reason, some racetracks don't do that. And I just don't get that. To me, IndyCar racing is, I mean, you look at those cars, they're fast, they're sexy, they're bred for speed, and they just excite me to no end. And so, we try to treat them as equals. It's tough because we don't have as many big names as I think we used to have. You know, like I said, I've been around this sport for a long time, so I was around Mario and Michael, and I worked with Danny Sullivan, and we had Rick Mears and Allanser Jr. and Allanser Sr. for that matter, and Bobby Rahal, and of course AJ, and on and on and on. And the number of names that are recognizable, it's tougher and tougher to come by. But we've got some very recognizable names. You know, certainly Danica has made a mark of her own. Elio is to me one of the bright personalities in all of sports, and I just love being around him and working with him because he's just so perfect and natural. Tony Kanaan has so much going for him that he's got such great appeal. Dario is incredibly desirable, articulate, presentable. You just go on and on. Dan Weldon, down the list. There's so many great talents in the car and out of the car, but it's tougher and tougher and tougher to break through. And as the media becomes more and more specialized, it's even harder to break through. Poor newspaper coverage and things of that nature, which is only going to get worse over time. More social media, things of that nature. It's tougher and tougher and tougher to gain the attention in big handfuls. It's little bites as opposed to the back in the day. If you got on the newspaper, you were home free. So you just got to work all year long and use every possible outlet that you have available to you. And some of those things we don't even know about right now. We're learning more and more about social media every single day. So It's a constant job, but it's a 365-day-a-year thing.
Does the lack of the driver awareness, though, of the IndyCar Series drivers, does a lot of that come down to getting the sponsors to do a better job of activating their sponsorship with these drivers?
Well, you know, one of the great fallacies, again, I've been involved in NASCAR for 30-something years, too, and one of the great fallacies is that NASCAR is this great marketing machine, and the truth is the sponsors have done a great job of marketing the drivers for NASCAR, and so, you know, it's a chicken and egg question, which comes first. So, you know, you got to have sponsors that have big budgets that can merchandise and market. You know, you walk into a convenience store before a NASCAR race, and you've got, you know, Casey Kane in the Budweiser car, and you've got Kurt Busch in the Miller Lite car, and on and on and on, and you know, we need that same thing to happen in IndyCar racing. But right now, you know, Budweiser or Miller Lite in those two cases aren't even involved in the sport. So, you know, do you need a bigger name driver to get them involved in the sport? The answer is yes. How do you get a bigger name? How do you become a bigger name driver? Well, you got to have the sponsor support. So, you know, it's a catch-22, and so we just all have to work harder and all have to work smarter. And the drivers have to be more accommodating than ever, and they're really, really good at IndyCar racing. I mean, really good. So you just got to keep working. There's no one answer. It's all those things.
Before we completely let NASCAR go away in this conversation, let me ask you real quick. There's been a lot of rumors over the years of a NASCAR-IndyCar doubleheader. We've heard that Phoenix offered it up a couple years ago, although they really gave IndyCar the short end of the stick. And there were some rumors, from myself included, I guess, that maybe you guys were going to announce that this year. Could those two organizations put on a successful doubleheader? And could a promoter or a track president like yourself make that work?
No, that's not going to happen. At least not in the near future. I don't see NASCAR ever agreeing to do that. And I got to tell you that the IndyCar drivers complained to me quite substantially complained to me about having to share the weekend with the trucks because the kind of rubber that the trucks put on the racetrack, they run a different line, and so they say it messes them up. Well, got to be honest, you know, for us, the trucks are every bit as profitable as the IndyCars. You know, to suggest that, well, you need to get rid of the trucks because it's an IndyCar weekend, that'd be every bit as wrong as suggesting that we should get rid of the IndyCars to have a truck race weekend. It's, you have to have both as a promoter. You have to have a main event and a support event. But in the case of the support event, we make just about as much money on the trucks, sometimes maybe more, because of sponsorship, because of television money and things like that off the trucks as we do off the IndyCars. So we need them both to make it work. It wouldn't work without the two. I can't imagine what we would hear if we put Cup guys on the racetrack and had those kind of issues to deal with. I just don't see it happening. I don't see NASCAR letting it happen. I just don't see it happening, to be honest. Love to do it, but believe me, I'd love doing everything first, and I don't see it happening, though.
Eddie, you speak specifically for Texas Motor Speedway, but you're also pretty high on the chain with Speedway Motorsports Incorporated, with SMI. We've seen over at least the last year or so, this aligning between SMI and the IndyCar Series, and it just seems right now that their goals kind of are in the same direction. Can you speak a little bit to that, of how those corporations, those entities, are kind of aligning themselves right now?
Well, the truth is that for a long time, our two companies have been aligned. If you go back to the early days, 98, 99, 2000 for IRL, the schedule outside of Indianapolis was largely at SMI tracks. Texas, Atlanta, Charlotte, Las Vegas, et cetera. So, in fact, I think one year outside of Indianapolis and one other place, it was all our speedways. So, you know, I just know that we want to race and. Again, our philosophy is if we don't make a big deal out of it, nobody else will. And we work hard. We're proud promoters. The word promoter to me is a complimentary term. I'm proud to be a promoter. I work hard at promoting, and I use the term track operator is a derisive term. There's too many track operators in racing today. So, you know, I don't know that it's anything new. It's just that we want to go racing. We got racetracks. Let's race.
Can the IndyCar series ever, in your eyes, go back to a Charlotte or Atlanta and be successful?
Well, I got to tell you, I think Charlotte is a tough one because of the personal toll that occurred there with a horrendously tragic situation for everybody involved. Mm-hmm. And so I can't speak to that. I wasn't there that night, and I do know the impact it took on a lot of people that I know well, and it was just a really devastating event. That being said, I think it's possible that to go back to Atlanta some point down the road, and particularly now that they've lost one of their cup races. Again, you need races if you run racetracks. So, you know, why not? So maybe that'll happen.
Is there any chance we'll ever see a fall IndyCar race again as well?
Probably not. And, you know, nobody wants to hear the story, and I probably can't get into all of it anyway. But I'll just say that the Indy Racing League has every bit as much to do with they're not running here in the fall as that falls squarely on them, and I'll leave it at that. So, you know, I love that event. I was thinking about it just the other day because the weather was so nice, and it was a great event here. Loved having the finale. Again, to me, you can't just have another race. We want to have something special going on, and I loved having that finale here. But the Indy Racing League, and this isn't Randy Bernard. This isn't those people, the folks there kind of overplayed their hand at one point and fouled up.
Very interesting. Well, Eddie Gossage, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you touching on some of these topics with us and giving some great insight into how things are running down there in Texas for us.
You bet. Things are going great for us for 2011, and we're going to have a great season and just love IndyCar racing. So, you know, like I said, when we announced the iconic chassis, you know, if you're not on board, you need to go find something else to do because, you know, this is a time to link arms, and all of us need to support the sport we love, and I just love IndyCar racing.
Well, so do we. Best of luck with the rest of your 2010 season. We look forward to what you have in store for 2011.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Thanks so much, Eddie.
And that, of course, was Eddie Gossage of Texas Motor Speedway. We thank Eddie very much for taking the time to talk with us. Just quickly before we wrap up, let's take a look ahead to Motegi. The championship fight looking very interesting going into this, and, of course, Homestead being the last two races of the season. And Will Power, his situation is pretty critical going into Motegi. He's only 17 points ahead of Dario Franchitti, and he has no choice at this stage but to keep Dario behind him, however far behind him it may be, if he wants to keep his championship hopes alive. The good news in Power's favor is that he's been looking stronger than I think many people expected in the oval races toward the end of the season, and he seems hungry to win one of these two that are left. I wouldn't be surprised to see him do it. Paul, what do you think?
I think he is past the two ovals now where he had the most concern. When you look at the last four ovals of Chicago, Kentucky, Japan, and Homestead, you can really look at them grouped in, you know, two sets of two, where Chicago and Kentucky are very aerodynamic tracks that are a lot of pack racing, a lot of weaving, a lot of side-by-side, the typical IndyCar, you know, dogfight type of track. Japan and Homestead, particularly Japan, are much more driver tracks. They're very different style of racing. Japan in particular is not it's a mile and a half, but it's a very different mile and a half. It's the egg-shaped one where the car, you can't necessarily run full throttle all the way around like you can at Chicago and Kentucky. It's much more sensitive to driver skill there. I think that's a track that will perform very well on, and I won't be at all surprised to see him win this event in a couple weeks at Motegi. Homestead is a little bit different. It's kind of somewhere in between. Homestead has seen some races that have been side-by-side, but traditionally it does get a little bit more strung out than what we saw at Chicago and Kentucky. We saw last year where Briscoe and Dixon were able to break free of the field, and they ran pretty much in a class of their own. And Dario was able to snare the win at the end by another fuel mileage deal. But I think Will has, he survived the ovals that he was most concerned about, but he certainly didn't flourish, and he certainly didn't come through unscathed from a points situation. He's taken a major beating the last week, couple weeks. He's gone from 59 points down to, what is it, 17 points, I think, now. And like you said, he is certainly at a he's certainly at a critical stage. Even if he finishes second the next two races and Dario wins the next two, that's enough for Dario to take the championship. I would say the thing that is surprising to me is that really for the second year in a row, we could see a Penske driver lose a seemingly a pretty safe points lead going into the last three or four races because of pit crew issues or pit stop incidents, I should say. Last year you had the issue at Japan where Briscoe just lit up his tires and crashed coming out of the pits, a very un-Penske-like driver situation. This year at Chicago, we saw the Will Power team just not put enough fuel in his car. And that's just not something you would expect from a Penske team. Then we saw at Kentucky, I don't know if Will lost his patience, if he just got caught out by some of the dirty air on an oval, but late in the race we saw him, for whatever reason, lose his car and almost put it in the wall, and that cost him a very good finish there, and he fell from probably a third place finish down to where he finished, about seventh or eighth, I think. So these little mistakes get magnified late in the season like this. And if Penske loses this championship because of these little mistakes again, it's going to be a tough pill for Roger to swallow. He doesn't take kindly to having little mistakes and things that not having all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. Those just aren't mistakes that you see the Ganassi team making these days.
The other significant thing that will be happening at Motegi this year is the AJ Foyt Oval Championship Cup will be handed out for the first time. So Dario is leading going into Motegi, the Oval Championship, and wouldn't it be an interesting situation to have the two contenders for the overall championship each take the cups in the two different disciplines going into the last race?
I think it shows the versatility of the series and the skills that are required to win the overall championship. I think it's a great thing.
So
but if Will does lose the overall championship, you can look back at his oval performance this year. Currently, he's sitting ninth in the oval trophy championship points. He can look at that ranking and you know point to that's where he lost the championship, because where Dario is sitting second in the road course behind Franchitti, that's a long way back to be sitting a ninth behind, and Dario is leading the oval. Sitting ninth is a long way behind first in the oval. That's a lot of points that Will has lost in those six or seven races to this point.
Well, and of course, it's worth pointing out that there is one more race in the road championship than there is in the oval championship.
That's true.
And so that having Dario finished in second in the road championship is that much more significant, because it speaks to how his skill is just that little bit more diverse.
Well, actually,
a little bit more well balanced.
There's two less ovals because there's one less oval on the schedule. But remember, Homestead does not count.
That's right.
For the oval championship. So there's only six, seven. Yeah, there's eight ovals. Seven of them count toward the oval championship. So
that's
two less events. You're right, but it's going to be an interesting fight coming down to the end. And Will is definitely going. I think Will has to win one of these last two races to hang on.
I think you're probably right,
and
but I wouldn't be surprised to see him do it.
I won't be surprised to see him win at Motegi.
Just a couple of quick notes on the Firestone Indy Lights series before we sign off. A couple things we wanted to address. Sebastian Saavedra. Has he thrown his career away?
I don't see how he gets another ride under the Indy Racing League banner, be it the Firestone Indy Lights or the IZOT IndyCar Series.
The story, of course, being that he, during the middle of a race weekend and with two races left to go in the season, quit his ride at Brian Herta Autosport, citing that he and his supporters felt that he was being given an unsafe race car. And I can't think of a precedent for this situation, but racers don't quit is the line that I keep hearing over and over.
Certainly not in the middle of a race weekend.
No, it just does not look good.
I could cut him a little more slack if he, on Monday morning, put out a release and says, I've decided to sever ties with Brian Herta Autosport, effective immediately, but not 12 hours before the race.
And on the other hand,
race weekend?
Yeah, and on the other hand, you look at Stefan Wilson, who he had a very pregnant pause in his interview during the race. Of course, he and Daniel Harrington, who had subbed in last minute, good for him, by the way, for Saavedra in the second Brian Herta car, and both of them were taken out by Philip Major in an accident that was completely not in any way their doing. And Stefan Wilson, in his post-race interview, was asked if he felt that the equipment was not up to par, or if Sebastian was justified in using that as a reason to leave. And after a very long pause, he deferred that answer to Brian and saying that he didn't want to get involved.
I think Stefan Wilson has had some gentlemanly training from his big brother.
He did very well. And if Stefan Wilson were to part ways with Brian Herta Autosport at the end of this season, everybody will look back at this and say, Stefan did it right and Sebastian did it wrong, especially after being given a shot at the 500.
The drama that
team went through to get that entry into the 500 and him learning that he was in on the grid while in the hospital. It's hard to justify going through something like that and then turning around in the same season and in such a cold and dismissive way, deciding to part ways in the middle of a race weekend. It's hard to swallow, for sure.
Yeah, and I don't see how he has another ride in the IndyCar series. I just don't see another team taking on that type of driver.
Who's going to gamble on him when there are so many other talented guys walking around with their helmets in their hands?
Exactly. No, I agree.
And the one final thing that we wanted to discuss was just to congratulate Pippa Mann on her first win in the Firestone Indy Lights series and the second woman ever to win an Indy Lights race, the first being Anna Beatriz.
And in an unusually dominating fashion. She did not win this one at the line. She just absolutely destroyed the
competition. Oh, yeah. She took off.
Wasn't it like a 5 or 8 second win or something like that?
It's very unusual margin for an oval. It was bizarre and utterly dominant. And so major congratulations go out to her. She's got to be very happy to see after the struggle that she had mid-season with her hand and having to take the race off at Mid-Ohio to come back from that and perform so well on the last couple of ovals, which I don't think anybody would have considered to be a specialty of hers. But with these last two finishes coupled with her pole position in Indy, I think that people are looking at Pippa under a different light. And so nothing but positive things to say for her. Congratulations.
We are going to have to teach her how to celebrate in victory lane, though. The pictures we saw, she just looked almost like she felt guilty about winning, like she was ashamed of being there. We're going to have to teach her next time. She's got to jump off the car, do what Hinchcliffe did at Chicago, you know, do the jump and heel tap and everything else. Live it up in victory lane, girl.
And with that, I think we've covered everything that we were hoping to discuss today. So unless, Paul, you've got anything else that comes to mind?
I've got nothing.
And we're going to call it a podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in for our first More Front Wing podcast, and we look forward to bringing you many more in the future. And remember, More Front Wing is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.